This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Everybody's talking about it, and we'd love you to as well as we go through the conversation on the chats, Substack, YouTube, Facebook, wherever you're watching. Weigh in, and we want to see your opinion. Mackenzie Shirilla, the crash, is what we're talking about. She was 17 when she was charged with four counts of murder for driving her car into a building in Strongsville, Ohio, killing Dominic Russo and Davion Flanagan. Her defense attorney raised the POTS diagnosis at trial, a condition that can cause fainting and loss of consciousness, but never really called any medical experts. So that really didn't weigh all that much on the judge. No jury here. No records, no testimony after the conviction. A neurologist found evidence consistent with a medical episode. The opinion was submitted in a post-conviction petition filed one day past Ohio's deadline. And that's where a lot of the conversation sits right now on Mackenzie Shirilla and the crash. Joining us to discuss, and we're going to go into three different parts here today, talking about the defense. Did they fail Mackenzie Shirilla? Also, we're going to look at the prosecution. Was it overreach? And what about going forward? Does she have a path to freedom at some point in time? I guess that really is up to her. Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, available wherever you get podcasts and on YouTube with us. And of course, Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program, is with us as well. Bob,
T,
I'm gonna start with it with you on this. I didn't know a ton about the case until I watched the Netflix doc, and then I didn't follow the trial when it was going on. I know you didn't either. I don't think any of us really did. So I'm catching up, but I feel like I've got a good catch up in the last week or two. After you watched the doc, after you just saw the surface information of everything that everybody's talking about, and we'll go into everything that's been dug into further in a little bit. We're not just talking surface here. What was your reaction to the case?
Something like this. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. I go into every Netflix documentary knowing that there's going to be gaping holes in what happened during the trial itself. So I knew that, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at it from my perspective saying, wow, seems like this defense attorney really shit the bed. That was the way I walked away from it. I was watching it with Allie, and we were both like, you know, like, we need to cover this because, number one, I want to see if I can find the trial, which I have not been able to find, by the way, online. People in my chat were saying the court TV, because it was a bench trial, meaning that there was no jury, and it was short. It was a couple of days, I think.
Yeah.
And you know, I desperately looked around for it. I couldn't find it. If anybody in chat is aware of where it might be,
yeah.
I know that they aired victim impact panels or the victim impact statements. I think they have the sentencing, but like, as far as the entire trial being somewhere, I'm not aware of it. And I'd really like to watch it.
Yeah.
Because like I said, there's just a lot of gaping holes, which we're going to talk about today.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's start with, because I want to talk about the defense in this this segment and how they served her, did not serve her. One of the big things that people are talking about after the fact from the documentary, the defense attorney raising the POTS diagnosis, but almost somewhat passively, if you will, of like, well, if you don't think it's that, maybe it's this. It's kind of how it feels like. The POTS diagnosis is essentially kind of a blood pressure issue where you stand up, you don't see things for a moment, you could black out. It happens a lot at that sort of age, but it can go on into adulthood and be a full-fledged diagnosis and condition. A lot of people have said, yeah, I don't think that really applies. There's an expert that says it does, but that expert never also got a chance to take the stand in this. Let's talk about that. The arguments for this being a medical emergency, whether it be POTS or whether it be something else that could have been going on here. How, in your opinion, as a defense attorney, how was that handled at trial? Was that adequately shown to the judge as a viable explanation? Could it have been shown to the judge as a viable explanation, or is it kind of a reach no matter how you look at it?
No, it was not addressed at all. I don't consider him mentioning it in opening and then mom talking about a diagnosis in any way, shape, or form handling that at all.
Yeah.
You know, it like that was the thing that had me scratching on my, because if this case lands on my desk and she tells me about this POTS diagnosis, I mean, the very first thing I'm doing is having her go get a full neurological examination, like the whole kit and caboodle, because that becomes your case.
Yeah.
I mean, because if it's not that, it was intentional and she's fucking guilty and she's going down. You know what I mean? Like, that's the only way that I could see to build any kind of reasonable doubt in this case. So I could not think of a tactical reason to announce to the judge. And again, this is a bench trial, not a jury trial, which means the judge is the trier of fact. It's the person making all the decisions, not only on what comes in and what stays out in terms of evidence, but in terms of whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty. So go ahead. I can hear you.
I want to ask one question. And I know I don't mean to step on you, Robin, or anything, because I know you got questions too. When it comes to a bench trial, Bob, do you typically see the level of expert witnesses being called up as you would with a jury trial? Is there a difference in that sort of a setting? Should there be a difference in that sort of a setting?
I think that there is. You're still going to need your experts.
Yeah. Because,
I mean, think of it in terms of your client gets convicted and for the purposes of appeal, okay, you need to put on essentially the same trial. Obviously, there's going to be things that you're not going to have to do in a bench trial with that particular witness that you might have to do with a jury, such as demonstratives, you know, where you have big boards blown up and, you know, they're explaining complex theories or scientific things that you know, might be over the jury's heads without a big, giant display for them to look at. But when you have a judge, you don't have to go as far. As far as putting on the evidence that this girl was actually diagnosed with POTS, here are the medical records. This is the treating physician, because without that evidence, you've got nothing. This isn't a trust me, bro situation. Whether it's whether it's a judge or a jury, you have to put on the evidence. So as far as kind of the bells and whistles that you can skip when you're doing a bench trial, you can push that to the side. You know, some of the things that you have to do, and that even goes to kind of the bravado by which you're trying the case, and, you know, where you may overact for the benefit of a jury, be more dramatic. You know, there is a certain amount of acting that goes on in the trial. You know, with that, with the judge, you can just put that to the side as well. So, you know, you're really focusing on the facts and the evidence in that particular situation, because none of that other stuff that you're talking about is going to impact the judge the way that it would impact jurors. So, you know, you absolutely have to put the evidence on any kind of medical evidence that you plan on making a part of your defense. And in my estimation, the medical side of this was the entire defense and they put none of it on.
Yeah.
And that was kind of, so here's my take on it. Cause again, I take every single data point as individually building or not building. And again, and this is your great optic on this, Bob, is the fact that like you always say, we don't know what's going on in our brain. And especially when the only data we're getting is from a Netflix edited presentation of her life, it's hard to know what the truth is. But here's what I saw because of what the data points I saw from her before. And I'm curious as to maybe why this was a reason why they didn't put this on. So we'll give the defense counsel benefit of the doubt that he's not a complete idiot, only half, not bringing this up, is it seemed like an afterthought. It didn't seem like, in other words, it wasn't their first thought reading and watching the family, the mother, the father, and her behavior when they found out about this. Their first thought was not like, oh my God, it's that damn POTS again kicking in. It was like, it wasn't even mentioned until everything looked like it was going south. That was my take on it, because as we said yesterday, you know, caveat for our audience, which everyone hates the fact that not everyone, but that she's guilty. She caused her death, but I do not believe, because these initial data points, that it was her intention to kill people. Her intention was to fear them into her compliance that she wanted through threatening them with their lives in a vehicle, which she'd done before. And so, not aware of the fact, because she's an idiot and a self-centered narcissist, that actions could actually get someone killed, including herself.
Right.
That aside, when you see that data point then as the intent, and then the parents seemingly, again, conjecturally, saw that as most likely the intent as well. And when they saw things are going south in a trial, then they say, oh, wait. Oh, what? POTS, let's try POTS. That's the way I took it.
Yeah, kind of felt like that. But I mean, that is how the doc framed it. But is that right? Is that how you would say, Bob, it came through in the court as well?
Well, I mean, it didn't come through in court. Like the POTS thing was right. Not raised with any substantive evidence. Mom sitting on there saying that she was diagnosed in 2017 without providing any evidence.
That's what I'm saying. It was raised, but it was not raised. It was raised in such a half-assed way that it really held no substance.
Yeah. Well, by the way, I don't know who to blame for that.
Yeah.
You know what
I
mean? Because we're not a party to the conversation
taking
place between Sharilla and her lawyer. We're not a party to the conversations that are taking place between, well, some of them we are, you know, the jail calls, obviously, but, you know, the behind the scenes prior to, you know, trial happening and, you know, wherever they were able to have any kind of conversation, which would have been tough between mother and daughter in terms of once she's in, they're recording everything, you know, they're overhearing everything, as we know, because those jail calls came out and, you know, some are pretrial, some are post-trial, and they're, you know, they're damning in the sense of trying to put the pieces together on how full of shit is Mackenzie Sharilla. You know what I mean? Because like when you get to that side of it, like, well, I don't remember. I don't have any recollection of it. Now, neurologically speaking, that's not some kind of impossibility. I could see a lot of reasons for that happening in that kind of a high stress situation leading up to them hitting the wall.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But again, I'm not a doctor.
Yeah.
So I need to bring on a neurologist to explain that, you know? So whatever was going on, and I hear exactly what your guys are saying, because it seems like that's the attorney's job, man.
Yeah.
Like that's the fucking attorney's job. When I get this case again, if it comes on my desk and I go talk to my client for the first time and it's, you know, and wherever she's being held, and I'm getting a attorney client room within the jail, and you know, theoretically you're having privacy, right? They're not listening in, so I'm able to openly communicate with my client. And in this situation, where I typically don't ask the question, "Did you do it?" In this particular circumstance, I'm going to ask, "Are you full of shit about not being able to remember anything?" Because that's something I need to know. Mm-hmm. You know, because if you're telling me the truth, then I'm going to go to your family and I'm going to have them mortgage the house, because we need to get experts in on this case that are going to be able to substantiate what you're saying to me. If you're telling me that you're telling me the truth, that you blacked out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like the problem from her perspective is, when does she black out? Because, you know, if you've seen the path, you've got the straightaway where she's gunning it. And, you know, and we pulled up on our live, we pulled up like the Google map, because I'm like, I would need to, like, it drove me nuts in the whole Netflix thing. I'm like, why didn't they show the whole fucking path?
Yeah.
Like just a clear graphic of exactly, you know, they show her turning calmly, perfectly, you know, driving like a champ.
With the blinker on. Turn.
Yeah. With the blinker, the whole thing. And then all of a sudden she guns it. Right. So you can imagine what's going on in the car. Right. Yeah. We heard enough of her interactions with Dom to have a pretty good idea of what's going on in that car. What the impetus of the argument was, I have no idea. It was probably some shit like, you know,
relationships. That's the impetus. Well,
probably the pointless shit that people at 17 argue about.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So
it's a different day.
But like to your point to both of you guys, I mean, I can't help but think that would have been the first thing that the attorney would have addressed. Because if you're trying to think of a defense here, that is the only defense that exists in my world. I'm like, I'm going to the family who I can speak freely with. I'm like, is there any way that she would pass out? And you would think that the first thing that would pop up in that conversation, she's like, oh, yeah, she has POTS. She was diagnosed. You know, so you would have thought that would have happened immediately.
Yeah. Like, where did this failure come into place? Exactly. Here is the question.
That's what we don't know.
Did mom reveal this right away, or dad, and it was not latched onto by the attorney as a lane to go down? Or was this like last minute? It's like, oh, by the way, like, why didn't you tell me that at the beginning or anywhere near? I mean, who knows? I mean, we don't know the answer to that. What we do know is this, the post-conviction petition with that expert opinion in was filed one day late, past Ohio's 365-day deadline. So they have 365 days, a full year, to file this petition, and they fuck it up still. So they fucked up the trial and getting this in. And then, okay, here's your window. Get your petition in, and you miss it by a day. I'm not a attorney, Bob. I don't know how this stuff works. I imagine, you know, you're gonna wait till the last minute if you're waiting on experts or anything that could possibly benefit your case to get it in, unless you are, okay, we got everything we need. And I can see maybe you're waiting to the last minute, but still, how do you screw this up when it's like, this is your window. This is your in to at least attempt to get an appeal going here. And you're tardy on it.
Makes
sense of that to me. Or is there no sense to be made?
I mean, it's a massive fuck up.
Yeah,
it is. I mean, talking one day and it's because of leap year.
This is like Seinfeld-y or something, you know?
And, you know, but that is literally the kind of mistake that keeps lawyers up all night. Like, it's kind of shit where you fuck up like that, where there's no one doing it. There's, you know, I mean, they're trying. They send it up to the Ohio Supreme Court to have them, you know, but like, it's a hard and fast rule. There are deadlines. Yeah. In the law that are fucking drop dead deadlines. And if you blow it, you blew it. You've completely committed malpractice, and there's no way around it. And, you know, in a civil case, it's devastating in a much different way. 'Cause you know what? You're going to end up, you know, hitting your malpractice insurance and paying the client out from your policy. I mean, that's why you carry it, because mistakes can be made.
Sure.
They were calendared wrong. You know, obviously, like, whatever happened, they didn't take to it. You know, waiting to the last fucking day to file anything with a statute with a limitation running on you is bad practice in general. I mean, it happens. You know, I mean,
sure.
But this thing is devastating because it's relating to her liberty, her freedom. You know, there is no paying what you would have made in the civil case type remedy for this. In this, she's fucked. You know, so this is literally the kind of shit you wake up in like in a sweat at 3 a.m. for the rest of your life on this type of mistake. It's why I'm always saying, I don't know of a tougher gig than being a defense attorney because of what is at stake. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, the two most important things are your health and your liberty, you know, in terms of just kind of overall, not taking into account, obviously, our families and things, but as a person, as a human being walking on the planet, your health and your freedom are the two biggest things out there, right? I mean, everything else, money comes and goes. It's all bullshit. Your health and your freedom. So, you know, when we're dealing with somebody's liberty and or their life in a death penalty case, the weight of that is oppressive, you know? And when you do it for decades, man, it really takes a toll on defense attorneys. So, yeah, I don't know what happened with that. I think that the trial lawyer and the lawyer that made that mistake were two different attorneys. Mm-hmm. I'm not 100% on that.
Yeah.
But I don't want to put that on the trial
lawyer. Sure, yeah.
It's not good practice to have the trial lawyer file an appeal or post-conviction relief stuff anyway. Like, you need somebody else, especially post-conviction relief stuff, because that's where you're really leaning into ineffective assistance of counsel, which, as we've talked about, would be something that if I were handling a post-conviction, I'd be looking pretty heavily at.
Yeah, you need somebody that knows that lane.
I'm also curious about this thing. I want to give the attorneys more benefit of the doubt, because I think the parents are so horrendous in this, and I think they need to be more culpable for what they created and their participation in it. Because the way I see this memory loss as an excuse for her, and we don't know, like you said, hasn't been tested, and it's the first thing you do, and Bob, that'd be a great question. Are you full of shit or not full of shit on this? Because everything depends on it. I think that was such a paramount question. And so let's have a conjecture that he asked that question, because I'll give benefit of doubt. He's got reps in doing his job like you, man, and he wants to do the righteous work the righteous way for his client. And based on, again, we only know what Netflix presented us, but based on a dad we're seeing, I can envision a situation, because a dad actually said it. I know when my daughter's lying, man. I'm good. She immediately grabbed to the defense she did of, I don't remember. And dad's going to now stand with it. The mother's going to stand with her. And so as the defense counsel's asking, did you do it or not do it? Do you remember or not remember? They all kind of rallying the flag around that. And so they're pushed aside. They didn't even think of, in my mind, from the data were presented, they didn't even think of this alternate idea of Potts until after the ship was sinking, because they're thinking she didn't do it. She gave appropriate responses towards the loss of life when the parents presented what her reaction was. That was actually appropriate. That's actually an empathetic, not someone intentionally doing it to other people, right? And so my thought process was, things didn't come up in time because they never even thought of it. This was an afterthought. And I think, do you think that could have impacted the filing timing as well? Or was it just a screw up on the attorney side?
I mean, are you talking about for the trial, or are you talking about for the post-conviction petition?
Either both.
Again, Robin, in that situation, you know, because the way that these things go is something like this goes down. You know, the family gets on the internet. They start looking for lawyers in their area. They start looking for criminal lawyers. They try to narrow it down to exactly the type of lawyer that they think that they need. They call. They don't know what kind of questions to ask. They don't know any of the things that really should be probed with that attorney in the calls. Like, I would always tell potential clients, I'm like, call a bunch of lawyers. You know, it's like you've seen what I've done in my career. You know, I have, you know, my records out there. And, you know, I mean, we're trial lawyers. We're very aggressive. You know, I mean, we may not be your cup of tea, you know, because, I mean, frankly, aggressive lawyers can make defendants nervous, you know, because they worry about, like, are you pissing the judge off? You know what I mean? Like, so
all shit matters, man.
It does. Like, all that shit matters. So, you know, but I'm always telling people, I'm like, you can't be afraid to ask lawyers how successful they are in terms of trial work. You know, like, have you ever tried a case? Start with that. You know, like, and this guy clearly,
right.
I mean, you only want my cousin Vinny, who turned out to be, you know, spectacular in the most unconventional way possible. But, you know, like, you got to ask those questions. So when they kind of land on the lawyer, all right, and he looked like he was an experienced attorney. He was an older gentleman. I'm not familiar with him. I thought that I read something that he was, you know, well thought of.
Yeah.
You know, by attorneys in the area. And, you know, you're having a very candid conversation with the parents who are going to be paying the fee. Now, they're not your client.
Yeah.
You know, but in terms of having access to Mackenzie and kind of who she is, they're an excellent resource, right? Yeah. And no disrespect to dad, but dad's full of shit. Like no one's a human lie detector. I guarantee you, Mackenzie lied to his ass 1,000 times and he had no idea during the course of the run. And that's no indictment on dad. That's what teenagers do. You know, yeah. I mean, I like to think that I can read my kids like an open book as well, but I guarantee you they've lied to me on many occasions.
Yeah. And you're not going on a dock going, oh, whatever she says is like, no. He's not in touch with the reality of a teenage girl, clearly, in that dock.
Exactly. And here's where I'm at with it, though.
Yeah.
Like, it's talking about the culpability of the parents is something different. And I hope that we're going to get into that conversation because it's a different conversation. Yeah. But in terms of, I put it on the lawyer. The parents aren't attorneys. They don't have to create a defense. That is entirely what they're paying a lawyer a bunch of money to do. So if he doesn't go in when he starts getting the discovery and say, all right, well, Mackenzie's saying that she blacked out. Okay, we know this, right? That's her thing. And then at some point she's saying she doesn't remember shit. Now, you know, I'm coming to the family. I'm saying, like, that conversation, okay, is there any medical reason that we're aware of that might have happened? And that's when the POTS thing would come up, right? Immediately. Like, if it's true, in my chat, and I know you guys are taking a bunch of shit, first time you covered it, much like Allie and I were on our chat, because we're just looking at it with general curiosity. We're asking probing questions. We're doing what we do. Mm-hmm. We're digging into a fucking case. I didn't watch the trial, so I don't have an opinion on it yet. Yeah. Like, I get that she's a narcissistic potential psychopath. I get that. I can see that. However, there does exist a possibility because of this pot shit that was dangled in front of us with no evidence that it actually existed, but it got my mind spinning. I'm like, all right, I got something here. That's why I was like, I'm leaning into that completely. And I'm finding out immediately when I get the fact pattern, if that's a possibility in terms of her blacking out, you know, because the other part of it, in terms of the no memory, is a different aspect of it.
It is.
You know, people, the human mind is a very complicated thing, and I'm going to a neurologist. I'm putting a neurologist on the stand. If that's what our defense is going to be. But again, it all boils down to that initial conversation that I'm having with her. Are you full of shit? Honestly, I need you not to fucking lie to me right now. Do you have no recollection what happened that night? Mm-hmm. Okay. And then I'm probing her. I'm not just taking her answer at face value. I'm going at her as her lawyer. I'm going to cross-examine her.
The thing is, she held a lot of the cards here too. And I want to go to our next chapter here in a second, but I just want to say this. She held the cards. She could have said, we got into an argument and I was mad. I hit the gas. They were trying to steer. I mean, she could have said 1,000 stories.
1,000 things.
That would have made you go, well, that was chaos in a fucking vehicle. Okay. Right. You weren't trying to kill your friends. You were all fucking nuts.
Yeah.
But she didn't. She didn't. She's still sticking with, I don't remember. And I believe she might not actually remember. That doesn't mean that she couldn't be a narcissistic little bitch and was sitting there going, I'm going to scare the shit out of these guys and floor it. And then the last minute, I'm going to slam on the brake or whatever, and we'll all be fine. Because kids do that sort of shit all the time. If you've never been in a car with a friend that does that short sort of shit at some point in your life and you're a grown-ass adult, consider yourself lucky because people do that sort of shit. And kids don't consider, hey, we might die by doing this. Could that have been the possibility? Yeah, it really is. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue the conversation. The Mackenzie Schirilla case was charged as a murder. 4 counts, not manslaughter, not reckless homicide, not vehicular assault, murder, which requires proof that intent beyond a reasonable doubt exists. The prosecution built that on surveillance footage, black box data, 93,000 text messages, and a prior threat. No confession, no note, no witness to intent. Let's go on that here for a moment. Just the counts themselves of murder. Was this an overcharged case without having... You can't get into her mind to know exactly what she was thinking. And there was no evidence or letters or anything of like, I'm going to go kill my friends today or anything of that sort that was brought into this trial itself. Was it overcharged with the jurisdiction thinking that they knew what her thought process was?
I mean, in retrospect, you have to say no. She was found guilty. Mm-hmm. They got their verdict.
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, but the reality is in that case, if it falls on my desk, if they retain me, I'm going in and I'm certainly arguing what you're arguing.
Yeah.
Like, are you fucking serious? You're coming in on this bullshit with a murder one? No, dude. Like I'm trying to have those discussions, which I'm sure this lawyer did as well. You know, you're trying to negotiate this thing down to a manslaughter.
Yeah.
You know, like you're trying to get her some kind of deal where you're like, okay, you know, because leading up to the trial, for all the warts that you pointed out as defense counsel, you're thinking there's no way they're getting murder one on that. They're never going to be able to prove her intent. You know, they're never going to be able to do it. And, you know, in that thinking, T is why they landed on a fucking bench trial.
Yeah.
You know, which is a huge risk.
Was that a big mistake? I mean, obviously, if you're looking at McKenzie, she's going, probably, yeah, it was a mistake because she ended up getting what she got. Or could it have been far worse if it had been a jury trial? Could she have been penalized even worse than she was? When she looks back on this, when you look back on this as a legal expert, was the bench trial, was that the route you would have taken too had you been representing her?
Well, I just want to be clear, in terms of sentencing, that doesn't have jack shit to do with the jury.
Okay.
You know, so like, like if she's convicted by a jury, then
sure,
she can come back for a sentencing hearing. So theoretically that could be the same, but you know, there's this thing that we call trial tax that, you know, it's an unwritten rule that if you have a case that a judge upon hearing that case decides, you know what, this should never have made it to trial. Like you had no actual defense here. Like you've wasted the county's money, the taxpayers' money, my time to go through this charade of a trial. And you know what? Now he's never saying this, or she's never saying this. This is what's going on in their mind, right? And they're like, I'm going to ding them a little bit. You're going to pay a little trial tax. You wanted to come to trial? Instead of taking the state's deal, I'm going to kick an extra 2 years on there for you. You know what I'm saying? Like, so that exists in the mind of lawyers where there could be a trial tax if you take something to trial that maybe shouldn't go to trial. This thing wasn't that. If they're going to die on the first degree murder hill, you've got to take it to trial.
Yeah.
If you cannot get them to move down to a more reasonable charge on this case, you're going to take it to trial. It's akin to you go to trial on a death penalty case because they're trying to fucking kill you. Mm-hmm. You know, you have nothing to lose but to take that thing to trial and see if you could put enough in there as the defense attorney, not even in the guilt phase, but to save your client's life. You're trying to beat the death penalty. You know, and that's why it's usually a huge carrot in most cases in a death penalty case for them to say, all right, you want to avoid trial, we'll pull the death penalty off. We'll pull the death penalty off the table. That's what happened in Koberger.
Right.
People like all the fucking lunatics out there that are still thinking that he didn't do this and that he was forced into bullshit. The guy wanted to save his own life. They gave him the carrot and he took it. Mm-hmm. You know, they tried. I mean, Ann Taylor did a fabulous job in that case. Yeah. It's like, she just did. I don't give a shit.
What I agree.
She filed everything known to man. She filed every pleading.
It's kitchen sink, man. It was going nonstop.
If you're charged with that, you want Ann Taylor.
We said it every single time we covered it. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, there are mandatory filings in death penalty cases. And she did all of them. And then some, you know, and like, I'm never going to question what she did or didn't do on that because she had access to the evidence. And she tried with all of her might, you know, and ultimately what she did I think was the impetus of them pulling the death penalty off the table. Because when you've got four sets of angry fucking parents, and I'm sorry to segue on it, I'll get right back into it. But it, you know, it kind of dovetails for me in terms of when you're trying to figure out whether or not bench or jury, it's so hard, you know, because it's like I usually am leaning into a bench. And it's ultimately the client's choice. Let's just be clear about that. It's not the lawyer's choice. As a lawyer, you could say, look, I'm going to walk you through this because it's your choice whether or not we should go bench or jury. And I'm going to give you all the caveats. I'm going to give you the pros and cons for both scenarios based on your fact pattern or your case. And in her case, you know, basically you're as the attorney, you are relying on that judge having reasonable doubt because that intent factor is so hard to prove with these facts. Like if you're the defense attorney, you're like, they can't use the last 5 seconds of the black box as proof for intent solely. They have to have more. I mean, yes, you can use it. It's effective. Circumstantial evidence is always used to prove intent, but like that's basically what they had, and then some out of context text messages.
I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the prosecution and what they used in terms of defining her character, if you will, because when you look at all this and you look at the texts that she was texting back and forth and the angriness and the self-centeredness and the narcissism, everything that you throw in there. I'll say this, and it's not saying it's an excuse or that it was right or that it was a healthy relationship or she was a good person, because none of those are true. She's a shitty human being. She likely would have created chaos, probably killed someone else at some point in time had this not happened. Just that's the path she seemed to be on, in my opinion. But again, but leading up to that and the cacophony of 91,000 text messages taken out of context, you pick and cherry pick the worst ones. If you do that to almost any teenager, you may, if you're going to do it the same sort of way, I guess almost any teenager could almost be a murderer by that sense. When you look at the recklessness as to how some of them speak to each other, maybe not all of them, maybe not your little angel for someone sitting at home going, my little Timmy could never do that. And then he kills your sister, the stepsister on the cruise ship. You know, that sort of shit. That's the reality of what's going on. And look, they're kids. We used to say shit like this aloud to each other. Now they text it, so now it's on an eternal record. And then you grow up and you realize how immature and stupid you were, because that's what you are when you're young. You're dumb. We all have been there. Obviously, she's still alive. Her friends are not. Her boyfriend is not. But she's forever now going into life, continuing into life with the thoughts that she had as a narcissistic 15, 16, 17-year-old on the record as her defining characteristics of life. She still seems to be living out those sort of characteristics. But again, they're not evidence of murder. They're evidence of being a shitty teenager. And there's a lot of shitty teenagers.
There are a lot of shitty teenagers. And this bleeds right back into that question you just asked about the bench or the jury.
Yeah.
You know, because here's the stark reality for everybody 40 and older. We have no fucking idea what it's like to be a teenager in today's day and age.
Yeah.
We have no idea. None of us do. I don't give a shit if you're on social media as a grown-ass adult. I don't care if you're on Twitter fighting some fucking bizarro world Karen Reed battle after the case has been tried and she's been found not guilty. Good on you. You have no idea what it's like to be a teenager with the pressures that are applied by social media on our kids. We have no idea. And you know who had no idea? That fucking judge. She was a Luddite up there. Like, if I know that's my judge, I am running a million miles away from a bench trial, because if you have a case that involves social media or technology and you have a judge that does not understand it, that it does not resonate with them, that it does not in any way affect their mindset in terms of how they might look at a case because they think it's irrelevant. That is not the judge for you in a case like this, because what the state did is they turned around and they tried the case in front of this judge as if she was a jury. That's the same case with the fucking pictures of her on Halloween right after. That's not evidence of shit.
Yeah.
And they used it to just sway the judge to use the emotion of it.
Yeah.
And like it was a cheap carny trick. Yeah. And the judge bid on it.
And that's a great point, Bob, because that's why you, from what I understand, that's why you want a jury. I mean, a bench trial versus a jury trial, because judges tend to be more fact and data analysis based and not emotionally based. And so I would think that no one, again, I'll go glass half full on their self-awareness, which I don't think they really have any, being the family. They've figured, all right, emotionally, she's a bad person, man. We can't go to a regular jury trial because she presents horrendously. So we really need someone analytically to look at this. So that's why they might have recommended, or the way they walked her down the aisle to making that choice herself to have a bench trial. And then the judge went emotional on her. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Unless you can get 20 fucking teenagers on your jury, then you're golden. Because right. Then every kid on there is going to know. Because like there exists many different lives that are on a social media platform, right? You've got the kids that are straight up just acting. Like every part of what they're putting out there is a show. It's a facade. They're nothing like what they're portraying in social media. Then you've got the kids like Mackenzie, who like literally thinks that she's gorgeous and a model. And she treats people like utter shit, as if she is like a high class New York model, you know, like the high. She's got this thing where she's so delusional about her social profile that she's taken it upon herself that she thinks that she's internet famous or TikTok famous or Instagram famous to the extent where she could treat people in her sphere like shit.
Yeah.
You know, so like, and those people exist out there, you know, like this internet, the social media famous, the influencer thing is so fucking annoying to me.
Yeah.
You know, cause like my kids will come to me like she's like famous. I'm like, famous for what? I'm like, well, she's on the internet. I'm like, okay, what does she do? Got big boobs. Okay. So she's famous for big boobs. All right. And I try to explain to my daughter, I'm like, that's not famous. That person has done nothing of note. Everything that you're seeing is bullshit. You know, it's like this fight that we have with our kids to try to get them to understand. I wish they'd ban it. Yeah. Social media for children needs to go away because it's destroying our children's minds, their confidence. Everything is being destroyed by social media, and it's what they spend the most time doing. It needs to fucking go away. This case is just the epitome of it. It's the epitome of it. This girl's entire life revolved around content being created. If she was smoking a bong, she was putting it on Insta or TikTok. If she was driving in her car, if she was trying on and out, every part of this kid's life.
Yeah.
Was centered around social media. It's not reality. She was living in an alternate universe in her mind that doesn't exist in the real world.
If it was a cult, we'd be looking at who's the cult leader? What's doing this? What's this coercive control that's driving this person to act in this sort of way? But because it comes through this, it's handled very differently and looked at very differently. Why? Because the adults in the room don't understand it. And I think that's what a lot of it comes down to. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue our conversation about the crash. Mackenzie Shirilla is serving 15 years to life. Her appeals are exhausted. Her first parole hearing isn't until 2037. That sounds like a long ways away. It's about 10 years. I know. It's like, what? And then Netflix called. She agreed to speak from prison. prison for the crash, so did her parents. The first time the public heard her voice since the conviction, she sat in front of cameras, soft-spoken and remorseful, insisting she has no memory. A fellow inmate immediately contradicted her, because of course she did, describing a completely different person behind bars, and the internet has tore this apart. What I am kind of surprised by, but I guess I shouldn't be, is the fact that everybody is shocked that after the crash, she went right back to being a self-centered, narcissistic little bitch. That's who she was before. That's who she's going to be after. That's her identity. That's all she knows. That's the recipe that makes this system work for her. It would be a huge outlier if suddenly she was remorseful and a different person. That would actually make me think you're guilty as shit if you're suddenly acting very like, oh, I didn't do. The fact that she's still being herself actually makes me believe her story more, quite honestly. It's not a deviation in behavior. And Robin, you talk about that all the time with, you know, arc of behavior. Her behavior didn't change after the accident. Still the same person, 100%.
Yeah, and again, just how she presented a few of the details is what were the wobbles in how she presented. That's why the memory loss was a wobble in how she presented that information. The afterthought on the pots is like she owned who she was when she was being natural, who she was when she was having her own conjectures and coming up with her own rationalizations or behaviors. That's where you had wobbles in how she presented. Yeah. And that's why then it became consistent with that life arc, because she was extremely predictable with how she presented information, herself, details, everything in life, until she came to the explanations about what went on that night. Yeah. So that's why I sell the wobbles right there.
Bob, I got to ask you. Okay, so she's 15 years to life. The judge already said, I think you're not going to get out in 15 years. I think you're going to keep burying yourself, basically, with your poor decisions and your attitude and your shitty everything. Netflix comes knocking. Hey, we want to do a documentary about this. You brought your daughter about you, Mackenzie. You're the attorney. What do you say? And then knowing that, well, there's some appeals we're going to be trying to file. We're going to try and make this go somewhere. Does going on Netflix and sharing your story seem like a great idea, knowing who your clients are? What would you be advising them when Netflix comes knocking?
I mean, that's a client by client determination.
Yeah. These are your clients.
For this particular client. And look, I mean, the direct appeal has been denied. At this point, she's blown. She blew the time statute on the post-conviction petition, which leaves her, just so people have an understanding, that the merits that she could have brought up in that initial first post-conviction petition, had it been filed timely, would have been the merits of the things that weren't done at trial. Now, the only path that she has is newly discovered evidence, and then down the road, you know, ineffective assistance of counsel. That's the only path she has. So all the things like the we were talking about, the neurologist that showed up and said, well, yeah, that's possible, that doesn't exist as a thing that she can use anymore.
Right.
It's not like it's that's dead in the water.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
good, I think it was invented anyway. Sorry, go
right.
ahead.
I mean, if she comes to me, I'm telling her, I don't think it's a good idea. You know, we have something that's pending in front of the Ohio Supreme Court. You know, I don't know how you're going to come off. Mm-hmm. You know, I've sat with you in a room, and to be honest with you, you don't come off that great. Now, if what's going to happen to you eventually, and I'd be telling her all this, you know, Mackenzie, is that this reality that's about to befall you in the next few months as you get into prison, is that somebody's going to knock the shit out of you in there. You're going to walk around with your "my shit don't stink" thing and thinking you're the queen, and somebody, a woman in prison, is going to knock you into next week, and you're going to soon realize that you ain't what you thought you were. And you're going to come to it's going to be a real come to Jesus moment for you in there, because that's the reality of prison. That thing that you do out there on the internet and on Insta and TikTok is not going to work in here, you know? And I'm here to tell you that if you make this documentary, and you think that it's going to help you inside, it's going to have the exact opposite effect for you inside. People are going to resent you in there that are stuck in there wondering, why is she getting a Netflix thing? It's a, you know, I would have come at it from a completely different approach, a much more rational approach, not right. so much from the legal side of it, but from her reality and how that's going to work out for her, most likely in prison, is not going to be great, you know? So,
and some obviously sympathize with her, some hate her more. Does, in your opinion, does public opinion affect a parole board?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. You know, what also affects a parole board is that if in 15 years, when she gets her first parole hearing, if she's still not accepting responsibility for it.
Yeah.
That has a huge impact on a parole board. That has a huge impact on the families that are going to be sitting behind her at that parole board hearing.
I want to say this, accepting responsibility for it, because I think, and that's the interesting thing of this whole case, and this is what I kind of walked away with on the doc, everybody has their own version of what accepting responsibility for it is. And Mackenzie has flat out, I mean, and the way she worded it was rather interesting on the doc too, that she, I don't have it in front of me, but that she was the driver in a tragedy of something of that nature is the way she worded it, that she says, you know, it's not that I don't have any responsibility, but I'm not a murderer. I didn't intend to kill those people. I am the driver of a tragedy that took the lives of two people. Okay, that is taking some responsibility. It's not flat out saying I went and killed them. And I know the families of these the victims certainly would love to hear that. One of them said they're not going to find peace basically until he hears those words. And Mackenzie says the truth, quote unquote. Now I get it. If I was a parent like that, I don't get it. I can't imagine what that feels like to be them. And I have so much sympathy for them. I can't begin to empathize because I can't imagine that pain. I would be in a corner in a room or dead. I don't think I could handle that sort of shit. But the fact that they're trying to move forward and they're trying to find some sort of peace. And I get your thought process is just admit you did this. Admit you did it on purpose. But if she can't do that, if she genuinely doesn't believe she did it on purpose, but she does, I was behind the wheel. I drove. I don't remember what happened. I mean, that's, you know, what is that? What is taking responsibility for it? Is it saying, yes, I did this on purpose? Or is it recognizing it the way she does of, I don't know what happened, but I certainly was behind the wheel.
Well, I think that at some point she's going to have to come to grips with the fact that she floored it.
Yeah.
You know, and for whatever may have happened in that last few seconds, whether she passed out, whether, like you said, Dom took the wheel and, you know, they're going 100 miles an hour in a Camry on unstable ground, like 100 miles an hour in a car that's not built to go 100 miles an hour when you're off the road is a whole thing in and of itself. Like the path in which that vehicle took and whether or not Dom was trying to save all of their lives, whether she passed out, like all those things still take a back seat to the fact that she gunned it. Mm-hmm. And she put him in that position for that to happen. But for her doing that, this accident never happened. So Even if she's going to sit there and say, well, you know, she's gonna die on the I can't remember it hill, she's gonna have to come to grips with the fact that everything happened as a result of her actions that night, and there's no one else to blame for it. Whether or not that's going to resonate with the parole board, she's going to have to go in and say it. She's going to have to go in and say, this was completely my fault. Yeah. You know, I may never agree on the intent aspect. And as I sit here today, I still can tell you with absolute certainty that I do not recall what happened in those final seconds. I don't know, you know, but I do realize, and I take full responsibility for the fact that everything that I did leading up to that car blasting into that wall at 100 miles an hour was completely my fault. Those two, my two friends are not alive because of what I did that night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if she goes in with that kind of thing, then, you know, and as Creek, I think Chaosify was saying, you know, they look at everything, how she's doing her time in there. You know, she's taking advantage of the educational opportunities. You know, you can get a degree in prison, you know, if you're going to do that, you know. Like somebody else is like wrote, like she had like 58 infractions. If she's going in there and just acting like the petulant child that she's always been and still is, and just going to continue that path, you know, she's not getting out in 15. Parole board stamp denied. See ya. You know?
Yeah. And I think as of when I looked up yesterday, she had 38 infractions, 36 were substantiated. And like you're saying, Bob, the only way path forward where, again, I think she's going to spend a lot more time than 15 years because, like you said, she hasn't owned anything. And for parole board to even get a consideration, it's just not that day of she has to own it. No, you need you. She only has 10 more years to show an arc of owning it. And if she doesn't start now, she's going to be in there a long time. So I think
time to start if she's going to do it. Yeah, yeah,
but here's the deal, guys. She was tried as a child. Like that's the part of this thing
that she's tried as an adult.
Well, I mean, that's right. She was tried as a child.
She was a child, tried as an adult.
Tried as an adult, but she was tried as a child as an adult.
Yes.
That's what I mean when I'm saying that. And she's still a child.
Yeah.
You know, and look, man, I mean, the science is clear in terms of the development of the brain.
Yeah.
Like we're not dealing with fully developed adults here. And like somebody on our last segment was talking like bombshell and I respect all your opinions, but I have pushback was like, you know, I like talking about, oh, blame it on social media. Yeah, I am bombshell. I am absolutely. It is a cancer on our kids. It just is. And if you're a kid, maybe you don't think so, but if you have children and you see what it does to them, I mean, it's a
rail to go off the rails.
Yeah.
1000%. And I think about that all the time of like, what if social media existed the way it does today? If I were a kid and had the feeling of, you know, being, you know, impenetrable. I could do anything. I mean, I had a radio station that I was able to get away with a lot of shit on, and Todd knows that. And I did within the confines of not getting, you know, any fines by the FCC. But if I had YouTube, if I had all this shit that was in my mind of what would be fun to do, and I'd probably be in jail. I'm just pushing things too far and going to crazy because you're young and dumb and the bumpers don't exist yet. And you don't have that extra voice to say, let's take a second here and maybe think this through. So I'm not at all surprised that she's in her early 20s now and still thinking like a petulant young teenager. Yeah. It's going to take a little bit of time. I hope it changes for her. And I hope she has the opportunity, I mean, she will as long as she's not dead, to make that change. But ultimately, it's going to be up to her, and it's going to be up to her to take a step back and go, I need to completely reevaluate my identity. And at the end of the day, the biggest problem with her is she doesn't have one. She's a shell of a human being. She always has been. She's chameleoning it in prison. You look at her on camera and it's like, oh, you're trying to look and act like the other prisoners. And I get it. It's survival at this point. But again, it's just another example of, She gets into an environment and she tries to become that environment to a weird extreme because she doesn't know regulation in her brain. She's never had it. Her parents never instilled it in her. And this is the monster you get when you have that recipe. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Tomorrow on the show, at 11 Central here live. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, the Minds of Mass Killers author, is also going to be breaking down this case since we're all talking about it. It's been very fascinating this week getting everybody's opinion from Bob, and then we're going to get into a psychological look at it again tomorrow. Go check out Bob's podcast, Defense Diaries, wherever you get podcasts and on YouTube. And
Buried Inside the John Wayne Gacy Investigation.
Available wherever you get podcasts. And Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me. Available wherever you get books and audiobooks. Go check it out. It's going to wrap it up. All right. Until next time, for Bob, for Robin and Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.